Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Wednesday, March 29th. Today we're going to go back to our special series of the World War II episodes. We're going to be chatting with our friend Barry Jacobson, military historian. And today we're going to talk about a couple of things. The road to Stalingrad, what was known as Operation Case Blue. This is a fascinating part of the war. And then one of my truly favorite parts, and that's the Marines in Guadalcanal. Which, of course, today we're going to get sort of a view from the Europe as well as a view from the Pacific. So let me say hello to our friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
Hello, Silvio. How are you?
Absolutely great. It's lovely here. I assume it's always lovely in Southern California. You know, why even ask you? It's always lovely out there.
Pretty much. We've had some rain, not this week or even this month, but up until now it was raining off and on. But we're now into spring, and as usual, San Diego is lovely. Sadly, I'm actually moving. I'm moving from San Diego to Los Angeles in the next 2 weeks.
So you're going to follow the Chargers then, right?
Yeah, that's really not my reason.
No, I know.
Like many San Diegans, I'm ready to tear up my Charger jersey in disgust at them leaving San Diego.
Well, the reason I had to joke with you on that is because we had often spoken during the last couple of years about the Chargers potentially moving to L.A., and I thought it was just – I couldn't help it. But come back at you on that one. Before we get to the topics, and they're fascinating topics today, I just wanted to bring up a couple of things. You wanted to talk about, and this is also incredible, what's happening in the UK. That they have officially signed a letter to exit the European Union. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, as your listeners probably have been following in the news, last year Britain had a vote before the American presidential elections to leave or to stay. There's a plebiscite put before the people. Whether they would leave or stay in the European Union. Britain had been part of the European Union since the early 70s. I think it was 74 when they joined. But there's been recently, particularly, widespread disgust with meddling by bureaucrats in Brussels in British affairs, and in particular, the inability of Britain to really steer its own course. Britain is part of, in fact, leader of the Commonwealth, which means it has relations with nations across the globe that were formerly part of the British Empire, from Australia and New Zealand to Singapore to various countries in Africa, even a few in South America. So it has the ability to trade within the Commonwealth to its advantage. But because it was a member of the EU, it was not allowed to use that advantage. It had to, all trade agreements had to go through the EU. So Britain ended up being a net contributor in way of money to the EU and getting less back. I think it was something like $28 million difference they were losing, which doesn't seem like a huge amount in Washington terms, but in terms of what they were giving, as opposed to what they were getting from the EU, they were a contributor to the EU and losing money. But the biggest issue was they couldn't control their own borders. And with the influx of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Muslim immigrants from Syria in the last year, that was sort of the tipping point. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Especially since England already has tremendous problems with its own immigrant Muslim population. London in particular has something like 90 Sharia courts in London administering Sharia justice on English soil, which is rather disgusting if you think about it. And the most common name in England is Mohammed. So I think the English people said that enough is enough. We're losing our country. And the EU is preventing us from saving it or fixing the situation. So they voted out. And today was the day they served England, served Europe with official divorce papers saying they were leaving the Union.
That's right. That's exactly how they called it in the news, by the way. When I was driving this afternoon, that's exactly how they referred to it as the making the divorce official 2 years 2 years down the road. I find it fascinating. If any of our listeners have a chance to go to the internet and look up an interview that Tucker Carlson did with a lady from, she's a journalist from England. Her last name is Hopkins. I don't remember her first name, but I'm sure they can find it if they put Tucker Carlson Hopkins. And this lady was talking about how divided the UK is between the people of London and the people in the interior. How the people in the interior, when they go to London, it's like saying, where am I? What country am I in? And that's unfortunately happening in many other cities in Europe as well. People, friends of mine who have been, I have a good friend who went to Paris a few years ago, and he was saying basically the same thing. Am I really in Paris? That was kind of the question he was asking. So I think there is a certain backlash. You know, there's this stuff about, you know, we want our country back. It sounds, you know, a lot of people like to refer to that as racist. I certainly don't. I think people have a right to be proud of their culture and to have their country promote their culture. And I understand exactly what's happening in the UK. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a few more of these divorce letters come from other countries in Europe, Barry.
No, in fact, France is going to be holding elections very soon, and it's not at all unlikely that the conservative candidate, De Le Pen, Le Pen, will probably, or at least has a good chance of winning, and she won't take France out of the EU. She is certainly going to take a harder line than her predecessors. There's also, you know, been talk that Denmark, Netherlands will also very soon have a very similar situation as Brexit. They call it Dexit in the case of Denmark, or Nexit in the case of Netherlands. It remains to be seen. I know that Eastern Europeans have taken a much harder line as well. Slovakia announced this week that they were not going to accept Muslim refugees anymore, that Muslim refugees should go to Saudi Arabia. They would only accept Christian Syrians who are facing genocide and real persecution. They would accept those into Slovakia, but not Muslims.
Mm, that's right. No, it's fascinating what's happening in Europe. It's something to keep an eye on over the next few years. Now, the other thing that happened on this day in history this week that I just wanted to briefly talk about is this is the week that the Spanish Civil War ended. 1939. And we talked about this in one of our shows. In fact, I put it up in Facebook today. It was chapter number 3 of our series, in where you talked about how the Spanish Civil War became the place where many of these German weapons and planes and bombs were actually tested, and it was a fascinating connection. So we have it there in Facebook if anybody wants to take a chance and go back and listen to it. I listened to it early this morning, Barry, and it was fascinating because on that show we talk also about Poland. So it was just a fascinating time, 1939, and the Spanish Civil War was a part of that, Barry.
Yes, it was. In fact, it's sort of an irony that Hitler and Mussolini, the leaders of the Axis, had put so much effort into securing a nationalist, which is to say fascist, victory in Spain under Francisco Franco. And they were fully expecting Spain would then cooperate with them, if not be an outright ally, during the war that would subsequently break out. And, of course, Spain didn't. Spain stayed neutral, not allowing the Germans, for instance, to use Spanish territory from which to launch an attack on Gibraltar, which would have severely damaged the British war effort in the Mediterranean. And Franco, because he stayed out of the war, was the only fascist leader of the 1930s who survived all the way into the 1970s when he finally died.
That's right. He died in 1975, Franco. His widow died not too long ago, by the way, Mrs. Franco, who was a pretty important part during. She played a backstage role, but she was a pretty important first lady while he was the president. All I can say about the Spanish Civil War, Barry, having grown up in a Latin American culture, that you never want to get into a fight between grandfathers arguing about the Spanish Civil War. Okay?
I take it you have firsthand evidence of this or firsthand
yes,
experience.
Yes, I have experience in that topic, and I have seen many of these fights in my younger life. And all I can tell you is you do not want to get in the middle of a couple of Spaniards of that generation. Now, most of them are dead right now. Obviously, my grandfather died almost 30 years ago. But I'm talking about, you know, my experiences in the 1960s. You do not want to get in the middle of a man who thinks that Franco saves Spain and another one who believes that Franco was a fascist dictator. You do not want to be in the middle of that fight because, I mean,
well,
it's going to get really hot. I can tell you that right
now. The irony is that both those positions are probably true. They're not mutually, they don't cancel each other out. I mean, Franco was a fascist dictator, yes, but did he save Spain from a communist dictator or a communist regime? Probably.
Yes. Well, the one thing, you know, it's like anything else with any other kind of dictator like Franco. There are people who defend Franco, and they will tell you that when Franco was in power, everything in Spain was smooth. You know, there was no crime. The parks were clean. I mean, it was a smooth running country.
The trains ran on time.
The trains ran on time.
The trains ran on time, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is you couldn't listen to the Beatles while you were in the train. And you couldn't watch certain movies, okay? Because
yes.
they had a real censorship on many of these things. So it was, I wish there had been a middle position, you know, somewhere in the middle between those two extremes, or very often it never gets to that. But by the way, one of the fascists who got very close to Franco in the late 1940s was Perón from Argentina, another one
That's
of the personalities
correct. Yes.
of that period. They had a certain kinship. Because I think it was Argentina who provided Franco with wheat or with food supplies while there was an embargo against him at one time. Well, let's talk about our most important fascist in this series, who is, of course, Hitler. And we find ourselves right now on the road to Stalingrad. That's going to be our first topic today, and then we'll talk about Guadalcanal later. We call this Operation Case Blue. So why don't you talk about that, Barry?
Well, as our listeners might remember, we had left the war in Europe in 1942. Hitler invaded Russia in 1941, Operation Barbarossa, in which he launched the largest land battle, largest land offensive in history, with some 3.8 million Germans and allies, mostly Germans, though, some 3,300 tanks, 7,000 pieces of artillery, 2,700 aircraft supporting the attack. Just this massive assault from basically Finland all the way to the Black Sea. And it had failed. It failed to take Moscow. It had bogged down in front of Leningrad, where they were at this point besieging the city. And during the winter counteroffensive, the Soviets actually pushed them back in many places, particularly around Moscow. So in spring of 1942, Hitler and his generals were contemplating the next step, and it was going to be a continuation of Barbarossa, hopefully knocking off the Soviet Union finally, before America could really get into the war. And keep in mind, America came into the war in the very end of 1941, after Pearl Harbor, Ironically, Hitler, 5 days later, after Pearl Harbor, actually 4.5 days later, declared war against the United States in support of his Japanese ally. It's ironic because he had no reason to do that. He already had his hands full with Russia and Britain. And so it was a real strategic mistake on his part. But it was fortunate for us because it would have been difficult for FDR, for Roosevelt, to have justified expanding the war into Europe in support of the British and to a lesser extent the Russians, because there was such anti-war sentiment against going to war in Europe once again after World War I. But Hitler accommodated us by declaring war. So getting back to Russia, Hitler's generals came up with Case Blue. This was the code name for a second offensive in Russia that would begin in the summer of 1942. And just to give you an idea how diminished the German forces were by this point, they could no longer attack across a broad front. Instead of 3.8 million troops, they now had only at their disposal about 1.3 million troops, so quite a bit less, almost one-third of what they had in 1941, the year before. It really had taken a toll on them, that the first year in Russia, as it would throughout the war. So the plan was cut down. It was a much more simple plan, though not at all unambitious. The plan called for an offensive only in the south of Russia. Called for an attack in the area we now know as the Ukraine, with the German forces beginning in central Russia near the town of Kursk, which was then in German hands, and the first step being a drive towards the Don River. And once they had reached the Don River, basically turning right or south, and with the Don protecting their left flank, they would clear out all the Russian forces between the Donets River and the Don. This would yield great economic benefits. The Don Basin, today known as the Donbass, which, by the way, is currently the scene of fighting between Putin and his forces and the Ukrainian national forces. The Donbass is a mineral-rich area, and it's rich in industry, Soviet industry. So Hitler wanted to capture that, but that was just the first step. The second step of Case Blue was once they cleared out the Don Basin, they would divide into two forces. Army Group South would divide into two parts, Army Group A and Army Group B. Army Group A would continue driving south into the Caucasus Mountains. The Caucasus Mountains, which is now Georgia, and because right there, just to the east of that, to the east of that, right along the Caspian Sea are the oil fields of the Caucasus at Baku. And that was the main goal. The main goal was to capture these oil fields. That was Army Group A's objective. And Army Group B, on the mean hand, would guard its left flank by attacking the city known as Stalingrad. This used to be called Volgograd because it's right on the Volga River, where the Don River and the Volga nearly meet. And by masking that with the 4th Panzer Army and the 6th Army, they would keep the Soviets contained and protect the flank of the advancing Army Group A as it advanced into the Caucasus. So that was the plan. And from the very beginning when it launched, Case Blue began. It began on the 20th of June, 1942. From the very beginning, it started running into problems. The first one was mostly logistical. The Russians collapsed and they fell back in front of the attack coming out of Kursk by 4th Panzer Army. But there were some immediate problems with fuel. The Germans just could not keep their spearheads fueled up. Their tanks kept running out of gas. This is going to be a continuous problem throughout the war. They had to use their air force, in fact, to draw airdrop fuel dumps and fuel depots to the advancing spearheads. The immense size of Russia just boggled the German imagination. The steppes of Ukraine are this vast sea of grass, and it just seemed to go on forever. It's much like the Pacific Ocean. It looks much smaller on maps than it does in reality. You know, once you're on the Pacific, you realize how huge this is. And it's the same thing in Russia. Once you get into Russia, you realize how huge it really is. And it kept dumbfounding the German planners. But they continued on after some fairly tough fighting. They managed to gain their objective on the Don and turn south and drive south throughout the summer. And when they reached the Don Basin, Hitler and his generals had another disagreement when their famous blow-ups, in which Hitler ended up firing the commander, General von Bock, and replacing him with General List, who a few months later he fired him as well, and took personal command of Army Group A. The big argument was which way to use 4th Panzer Army, whether it was needed in the Caucasus Mountains with the Army Group A, or was it needed to mass Stalingrad. It ended up doing really neither. It ended up clogging up the roads initially by putting just too many troops on very bad roads leading into the Caucasus and slowing down Army Group A. And then when it finally turned back towards Stalingrad to help the 6th Army to mass Stalingrad, it got there too late to be any real help. And this is where things really began to come off the rails. And we're not going to talk about the Battle of Stalingrad today because that takes an entire episode all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we really want to get to Guadalcanal. But at this point, Cates Blue begins to come unraveled when Army Group A gets into the Caucasus Mountains and discovers, lo and behold, the Caucasus Mountains have mountains.
and
we have no mountain troops deployed there. Right. The Italian Alpine Corps that was supposed to be there had been diverted to help attack Stalingrad. And panzers don't work very well in the mountains, do they?
No, they're very good, but not for that. Let me do this, Barry. Let me take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and get into Guadalcanal. I have a quick question also about Cates Blue right after this.
This is Carlos Quedes, harpist, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
Well, this is the place to be on Saturday nights, but I do have a message for the audience. Barry, you're going to laugh when you hear this. 2% of the audience last month was in Russia. They send you these figures. You know, Block Talk Radio sends you this map. And 2% of our audience last month was in Russia. So my message to our friends in Russia who are listening is that I think you may, if you're going to come to see Carlos here, you're going to probably spend a lot of money on the trip over. So you may want to maybe find some other, maybe it'd be easier to have Carlos fly to Russia and play over there, Barry. But I was surprised. 2% of our audience comes from Russia. So that was a pretty cool number, Barry. Not a lot of people, but it's a number that surprised me a great deal. So maybe they're following our series.
Yeah, I hope they enjoy it.
I hope so, too. I hope they're not going to tie us in with Trump and Russia, though. That was my concern, that we get called to the Senate
committee. Actually, Trump is pretty popular in Russia right now. So, I don't know. So we left the battle, and I'm going to quickly close up this portion and get on to Guadalcanal by just saying that by August, the Germans' offensive had reached Stalingrad, with the 6th Army, commanded by a man named Friedrich von Paulus, tasked with masking the city. But very quickly, Hitler changed the directives from simply masking the city, meaning you don't really enter it, you simply block it off, you know, keep the Russians from using it to attack from. But in order to push the Russians past the Volga, east of the Volga, thus protecting the flank of the first Army Group A advancing the Caucasus, it was decided Stalingrad had to be taken. And I think there was something of a little bit of ego here because Stalin was Hitler's great rival, and this was the city of his namesake. This is the city named after him. So Hitler thought it would be a great way to, propaganda-wise, to win a victory by taking Stalin's own city. So he ordered 6th Army into the city. Now, immediately the problems there began because the Germans had been bombing it aerially for a month, and the city was just rubble by this point. So tanks, much like they don't do very well in mountains, they do even worse in street fighting over rubble. And we're talking about mounds of rubble, whole buildings have collapsed into the street. And a Sixth Army kept, you know, feeding troops into the city. It became a street battle, a battle of rats, they called it, in which very quickly the fighting over the mounds on top of the city transferred underground into the sewer system as well. And the battles were in the subterranean basements of burnt out or destroyed buildings. The battles were fought in the sewer systems. We'll talk about that when we get the Battle of Stalingrad. But it soon consumed all of Sixth Army in this street battle to try to control the city. And that was and began in August. Interesting enough, the commissar commanding the Soviet political force in Stalingrad, in the Red Army, there was always a military and political component to every unit. The Marshal Yermenko was in charge of the city, but his counterpart politically was a fellow by the name of Nikita Khrushchev. You may know that name from the Cuban Missile Crisis. He later became the Soviet premier.
That's right. That's right. Little fat guy. I remember that's what they used to call him, I think, in Russia. I read that's what they used to call him, the little fat guy.
Well, that little fat guy who called Stalin the boss was in charge of making sure that the troops fought, you know, like lions. And the way he did that was he had his own NKVD, which was the paramilitary arm of the Communist Party, a forerunner to the KGB. These guys were armed, and they basically stand behind the regular army formations with machine guns, with submachine guns, or even ground-mounted machine guns, heavy machine guns. And if formations try to retreat or run away from the battle, they would machine gun their own troops. So you had the Germans in front of you, and you had the NKVD behind you. And you're just better off standing your ground or fighting than running away.
Right. And I just wanted to say very quickly, I wanted to say that over the last week or so, pure coincidence, they were showing that movie Enemy at the Door, at the Gates, which is, you know, not at this point in our episodes, but later. And when you see that movie, I mean, that really takes you to the reality of what was happening in that city, the fighting that you're talking about. I mean, pretty bizarre. I mean, I'm sure there have been other wars, I'm sure, that have been just as bad, but man, that had to be one of the worst.
It really did, and it got particularly bad when the winter set in. But we'll get to that next week. Next week will be the Battle of Stalingrad, which is the turning point in the war in Russia. Up until that point, the Germans had the strategic initiative throughout the Russian campaigns. And after that, they were always for the most part, on the strategic defensive. There will be one brief moment at Kursk in the following year, but we'll get to that also in time. So let's leave Russia for now, as the Germans are preparing to attack and beginning the attack on Stalingrad and driving to the Caucasus Mountains. And let's move on to the Pacific at the same time.
Let me ask you, before we get to Guadalcanal, I just wanted to get this question out of the way so that I don't forget later on. I think the question that everybody, historians, will ask is why didn't he go directly to Moscow? You know, why? And you explained it a little bit, saying it was a bit of an ego trip there, right?
That was part of it, but the main reason, there are two main reasons the 42 offensive didn't focus on Moscow. The first was the Soviets had spent the wintertime building a massive defenses in front of that city. The reason it had been, it was possible they could have taken Moscow in 41, particularly in August, when Gagarin was driving towards the city from Belorussia and was diverted instead down south to Kiev, was because there was no defenses. The city was undefended. It was virtually open. But by summer of 1942, the Russians had spent the entire winter building massive anti-tank obstacles and massive entrenchments and had a huge number of forces surrounding and defending Moscow. And the second reason was that Hitler, even in 41, didn't seem to realize the strategic importance of Moscow. He was always focused more on the economic benefits to be had of taking the Caucasus oil fields, the industrial heart of Russia at the Donbass. He was always more focused on the economic, capturing the economic sinews of war, they call it. You know, the sinews, the muscle, what it takes to fuel an industrial army, and taking that away from the Russians. He didn't realize that Moscow was a huge political center as well as a railroad hub. And by taking Moscow, it would not only have been a huge psychological blow to the Soviet regime, but it would have crippled their rail transport capability since almost all their rail went through Moscow. But that was one of the reasons, one of the main reasons he lost that war was he was failed to take Moscow in 1941.
Well, let's move on to the Pacific then.
Well, as we've been talking about in the Pacific, the Japanese have been, of course, running wild. They've had a major setback in June of 1942 when they were defeated at the Battle of Midway. But they still have a strategic initiative, meaning they could attack where they wished. And in the late summer of 1942, the Japanese invaded the island of Papua New Guinea and were driving from the north shore over the mountains that run down right down the center of the island. They're driving south to capture on the south shore Port Moresby. And the reason for that was it would do two things. One thing, it would threaten Australia, and there was some talk of Japan actually invading Australia. But if they could knock out that one base at Port Moresby, it was an Australian base, as well as occupy the Solomon Islands, which run to the east and south of New Guinea, they would cut off communications between, they cut the sea links between Hawaii and both New Zealand and Australia. So after the repulse of Midway, they occupy the Solomon Islands, building a major base at Rabaul, and began building an airfield at Guadalcanal, which is a small island in the Solomons, as well as driving their main effort, driving again through New Guinea towards Port Moresby. And that alarmed American planners, and it was decided that we were going to stop them at Guadalcanal, but it's going to be the first American naval amphibious attack, amphibious landing of the war. And in fact, it was the first major offensive that the United States or the Allies in general, made in the Pacific theater. And in early August, we landed on Guadalcanal with some 11,000 troops of the 1st Marine Division led by General Vandegrift. It was called Operation Watchtower, though the Marines very quickly started calling it Operation Shoestring because they ran out of supplies almost immediately within 2 weeks.
Hmm.
And largely because as they were unloading supplies from the naval ships on the northern shore, and I'll get to why they land on the north shore in just a second, of Guadalcanal, the Japanese Navy attacked, counterattacked. Japanese were, by the way, completely taken by surprise by our attack on Guadalcanal. But they rallied, and within a day they were making air attacks on the ships in the sound north of Guadalcanal, north of the landing zone. And the ships... we suffered one loss and some wounded ships as well. So the Navy hightailed it out of there. There was some skirmishing back and forth, and in fact, a couple days later, there was 4 cruisers sunk, American and one Australian, 3 American and one Australian. And Admiral Fletcher got cold feet, and he pulled out, leaving the Marines stranded with only half their supplies on Guadalcanal. So it didn't start off well for the Americans. The landing was unopposed because the Japanese weren't expecting it. The Japanese only had about 2,000 personnel on Guadalcanal. Most of those were construction battalions building an airstrip. And that airfield, which we took over immediately, we captured it on the north shore. We dubbed it Henderson Field. And by the end of August, American planes would begin to land there to provide scout cover and air cover for the Marines. But for the most part, the Marines were stranded for that first month with no supplies. So it became called Operation Shoestring by the Marines with some humor. The Japanese would soon counterattack, though, and they did it in 3 different waves. Fortunately for us, some of the naval battles that took place, and there were several skirmishes throughout the Battle of Guadalcanal that took place between August and November of 1942, we'll talk about a couple of those towards the end here. But all of them did one thing that was beneficial to us. They scared the Japanese high command into, instead of supplying by daytime and with naval transports landing forces on the island, they became convinced that that was too dangerous, that American air power and American air raids might sink those transports, which were fairly slow. So the Japanese started bringing in their troops and supplies by destroyers at nighttime. And this meant a very slow trickle of buildup. And so the history of the Battle of Guadalcanal is that the Americans landed a huge force unsupplied on Guadalcanal, 11,000 men, the 1st Marines. And the Japanese trickle in new reinforcements to the small garrison there, build up a force, attack, tend to lose, build up another force, attack, lose, build up another force, attack, and lose. And we'll talk about those three successive offensives in just a second. But it was that was the ebb and flow of the Battle of Guadalcanal. And it pitted two elite forces against each other. It pitted the American Marines, which considered themselves an elite and had a higher standard of training than the doughboys, than the army, or the dog faces, as they called them, and it against the Japanese, who at that point had never been defeated. And I mean, they had never been defeated. The Japanese, going back to 1900, against the Russians, and even a few years before that when they fought the Chinese, the Japanese had this long history of success. And by this point, they fought the Chinese. The troops they brought in Guadalcanal were veterans. They'd been fighting in China. Some had been fighting in Philippines against MacArthur, where they had defeated MacArthur's forces at Bataan earlier in 42. So the Japanese were very confident. And in fact, they were overconfident. They had what we call victory disease, meaning they thought they were invincible. And the very first major engagement on Guadalcanal, after a month of basically nothing much happening, was called the Battle of Teneru, which is a little river just to the east of the airfield at Henderson. The Americans at this point basically were in a perimeter surrounding Henderson Field on the north shore of Guadalcanal, and the Japanese were probing in the jungles all around. On August 21st, the Japanese landed a naval landing force of some 900 men. And this was going to be just the advance force to a much larger reinforcement. And it landed to the east of the field and began advancing towards the American perimeter. Fortunately for the Americans, we got word through by accident. One of our patrols was out looking for oranges, of all things, because troops are so short of supplies, they had to forage for food. The Japanese, by the way, weren't doing much better. The Japanese were mostly eating coconuts. What little rice they had. But the Americans were probing, and American patrol ran to a Japanese forward unit that was laying wire, and some 900 Japanese troops were advancing right behind them towards the eastern perimeter of the American line. So we quickly fortified that section at a place called Alligator Creek. The maps, American maps are wrong. They called it the Teneru River. And actually, the Teneru River was further east than where the battle actually takes place. It was actually a place called Alligator Creek, which is a misnomer because there are no alligators in Guadalcanal. There are crocodiles, but Americans didn't know that. They didn't know any better, so they called it Alligator Creek. It's a tidal lagoon separated by a sandbar from the ocean, from the north coast. Very little beach there, some rocky beach, but mostly it's a sandbar about 4 men wide that crosses right there, this tidal lagoon. And the Japanese were making straight for it because once they cross this spit of sand, they cross this this sandbar, they could end up advancing right along the coast right into the airfield. So the Japanese commander was going to launch his attack at nighttime towards Henderson Field along this coast, crossing the Alligator Creek at the sandbar. Knowing they were coming, we formed up our position on the west side of the creek and mounted machine guns right along the coast there, right along the riverbed, and particularly one particular machine gun right at the western end of the sandbar where the Japanese had to come. And then we strung some barbed wire along the sandbar as well. And we'd fill the tin cans with rocks or spent shell casings and hang these cans from the wire, so when you hit the wire, you'd rattle the cans and be kind of an advanced warning. You know, we could hear the sound of someone coming over the wire. So the Japanese hit the wire at about midnight on August 21st, and we began opening fire on them. And the first 100 men the Japanese sent charged forward with a bayonet attack. And by the way, they were surprised. They didn't expect to meet the Americans as soon. They thought we were defending much closer to the airfield. And as they're crossing the spit of sand and the sandbar, they were just mowed down in mass. And they kept coming, and they kept being shot down. There was an interesting incident happened. There was a machine gun right there, as I said, on the sandbar. It was manned by a Sergeant Schmidt, and his loader was a guy named Corporal Leroy Diamond. And early in the battle, the first gunner manning that machine gun had been shot in the head, but his trigger finger got held onto the trigger. It froze locked on the trigger. And he continued firing 200 more rounds, killing Japanese, even after he was dead. And talk about things going badly for the Japanese. Even our dead people were killing more of them than they were killing of us.
Yeah, that's...
And then Sergeant Diamond, Sergeant Schmidt and Leroy Diamond take over the machine gun. And they just mow down the entire first wave of Japanese. And the next wave comes, and they mow these guys down. And at some point, a grenade lands right in front of their position and explodes, and shrapnel hits Sergeant Schmidt, the gunner, in the eyes. And it hits Corporal Diamond, his loader, in the hands. So the gunner has no eyes, and the loader has no hands to load. So but he has eyes to see. So what they end up doing is Schmidt, who can't see, shoots the machine gun with his hands that are good. And Diamond, who is you can't load because he has no hands, uses his eyes to spot for the gunner. So he says, you know, traverse left, traverse right, 2 degrees this way, 2 degrees that way. And all night, they're mowing down Japanese, this team of one blind man and a man with no hands. Astonishing story. The battle ended at dawn with the Japanese being driven out by a counterattack. And the results were of the 916 Japanese that launched that attack that night, the Battle of Alligator Creek, 777 were killed. The Marines, they lost 34 men. And that's the way that Guadalcanal will go. And it's the first inkling the Japanese have that the tactics they're using, which date back to World War I, and rely on the code of Bushido and this Bushi spirit, the warrior spirit of the Japanese, where they, so far, they've always been able to defeat their enemy by just charging forward with bayonets. And you know, the Chinese with big break and run, the Russians with collapse. But against the American Marines, they were against a whole different kind of animal. The Marines stayed calm. They maintained themselves in their fighting positions, always dug in, using cover and concealment when possible, and steadily poured fire into the Japanese. Also, the Marines had a large number of heavy machine guns, more than probably any other fighting unit in the world. The Marines had more heavy machine guns per unit than any other fighting force. This allowed a very small number of Marines to hold down and destroy large units, as long as they maintain their fire integrity, which we'll get to in a few minutes with the story of John Bazelon. But the Japanese learned two things. One, that their bayonet tactics don't work against Americans. And secondly, the Marines are much tougher than any opponent, much calmer under fire than any opponent they've ever faced in the history of the Japanese Empire. So there's a lull in the fighting in Guadalcanal. And the following month of September, the Japanese had built up and launched their second offensive. This one to attack from the southwest this time, to take a ridge that overlooks Henderson Field. And this ridge is occupied by a battalion of American raiders, Marine Corps raiders. And they're led by a pretty extraordinary fellow. His name is Merritt Edson. He's also known as Redbeard Edson, or Red Mike, actually, Red Mike Edson. He used to have a red beard when he was stationed with the Marines in Nicaragua in the 1930s. And he is an extraordinary character, this Edson. Later he would be promoted to general, and he won the Medal of Honor in this battle. His raider battalion had occupied this ridge, and the numbers were very much against him. It was basically some – let me find my number here I'll find it in just a second. But in case he had about a battalion of against some 2,500 Japanese. He had about a battalion of raiders, which is somewhere around 400 to 600. And the Japanese assaulted over 2 days, trying to take this ridge, two nights. It became known as Bloody Ridge. Originally it was called Edson's Ridge because he defended it. And by the time they counted the casualties and the stacks of dead at the foot of this ridge, as the Japanese launched one attack after another, eventually it became called Bloody Ridge. And it became a strategic battle in the Battle of Guadalcanal and really in the war, because Edson stopped the Japanese cold. At the loss of 80 Marines, he killed some 830 Japanese, 10 to 1, more than 10 to 1. It got to the point where the Marines would simply roll down grenades down the slope of the ridge into the advancing Japanese and blow them up. And when the Japanese would begin to push through, Edson was, by the way, the man would stand behind the trenches, upright where everyone else is laying flat on their bellies under this hail of fire. And he would walk calmly up and down the trenches directing his men's fire. And they broke the Japanese attack in 2 days, causing enormous casualties. And that spooked the Japanese high command. At that point, they were still attacking towards Port Moresby and making progress, advancing south through New Guinea. But this was the same command, and Guadalcanal fell under the same command. It was called the South Seas Command. And the Japanese commander, Admiral Yamamoto, his headquarters was a truck, he was the overall commander of the Japanese Navy, decided to call off the attack on Port Moresby and any thoughts of invading Australia because of the casualties they're sustaining against the Marines in Guadalcanal. The Japanese came to the conclusion that the only way they were going to be able to take Guadalcanal back and drive the Marines out was they put all the resources available into this attack. That's how a handful of Marines, less than 800 guys in one battle, were able to change the tide of history and change the way the Japanese thought about battle and turn them away from their strategic objective of taking Australia to a much lesser objective, simply holding on Guadalcanal. So that takes us to September, and the Japanese have lost twice now trying to drive the Americans off of Henderson Field. And so at the end of that month, the Japanese are massing for one more final attack. And this is in the month of October. This will come from the south this time. They attack from the east, they attack from the west, now they drive up from the jungles of the south. And in a night attack, they're going to launch an attack on Henderson Field. The Americans are racked with dysentery. Again, we have very little supplies. Our troops are, in many cases, very hungry, as are the Japanese. The area they attack is commanded by Chesty Puller's 7th Marine Regiment. And some 700 Marines versus about 4,200 Japanese attackers. They attack in massive waves all night. The section they attack at is defended partially by two sections of machine guns commanded by a guy named Sergeant John Bazelon. Bazelon's an amazing character. He's a Marine's Marine. He started in the Army in the 1930s and served in the Philippines. And he was sort of a happy-go-lucky guy. Got into a lot of bar fights and spent a lot of time in downtown Manila getting into trouble, and was known as Manila John Bazelon. Came from a New Jersey Italian family. He was one of 10 children. Father was a tailor who'd come over in 1903 from Italy. You know, a big American Italian family. And when Pearl Harbor came, he was out of the Army, been out for 2 years. He decided to rejoin the military, and he was afraid for his buddies who were over in Bataan fighting against the Japanese. He thought the best way to get back to his buddies was to join the Marines with the expectation that the Marines would be the first to fight. So he was quickly promoted to sergeant, and he ended up commanding a section of machine guns, these 30 caliber water-cooled machine guns that were so popular with the Marines. And when I say a section is two guns. He commanded two sections, so four guns defending this section of the front when the Japanese launched this massive attack. And the machine guns start breaking down fairly rapidly. They have jams. They have some guns go down. Bazelon very calmly all night, walks back and forth along his sections, repairing guns, bringing up new ammunition, bringing up water for the cooling system, and they have to replenish the cooling system, manning guns himself, mowing down Japanese. At one point, the Japanese knock out one section and two guns are overrun. Bazelon picks up a gun from the section still under operation, still working, picks this heavy machine gun up, walks over to the jungle of the area where the Japanese are breaking through, and mows them down holding this machine gun, which weighs a lot, and then sets the machine gun up behind the position where it, which had been overrun, and mans it himself while he cuts Japanese down. Later that night, he had to run to the rear to get more ammunition. He ran into infiltrators, Japanese infiltrated through the lines, and with a 45 caliber pistol in one hand and a machete in the other, he hacked and slashed and fought his way through the jungle back and forth from headquarters back to his troops where he brought more ammunition. Personally responsible for killing some 33 Japanese in that running fight during throughout the jungle. All in all, the Japanese lost, aside from 30 killed by John Bazelon, Japanese lost some 2,500 troops in the Battle of Henderson Field. And that broke the attack on Guadalcanal. The Japanese never regained the initiative, and though the battle stretched on to February, that was the last major offensive. John Bazelon, by the way, got the Medal of Honor for that engagement, as well as the Navy Cross. He's the only enlisted Marine to ever get both those decorations, the highest and the second highest medal. And he was the first Medal of Honor winner of World War II among the Marines. To this day, there's a new ship that was just named in his honor, the John Bazelon. There are highways in California. There's a bridge in New Jersey named after him. He's one of the great heroes of the Marine Corps, and that's where he won his first medal.
And you send me a video, which I liked a lot about his life, and I hope maybe you post that video on your military page or on the page that we're doing together, because that was really a fascinating story of John Bazelon. Well, we're pretty much out of time today, Barry. Fascinating stories, both Guadalcanal. Sounds like a Spanish name to me. I don't know. I always.
It might be. You know, Spanish did have an empire.
It has that sound. You know, it has that sound that it's a Spanish name. It doesn't sound like, anyway, I could be wrong, but it has that, you know, certain tone in the name, Guadalcanal. Canal, of course, is the word in Spanish, so maybe that's where. I might have to dig that up. I'm fascinated all of a sudden by the origin of that name. But next week, we're going back to Europe, right?
Next week, we're going to go back and talk about the Battle of Stalingrad, the turning point in Russia.
And like I mentioned at the beginning, a while back, that movie, The Enemy at the Gate, is it called The Enemy at the Gate, right? Yeah, that is a...
Enemy at the Gate.
It's a tough movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough movie to watch. I mean, I would not recommend it to... I would not recommend it to children, and I wouldn't recommend that women watch it by themselves, because that is a rough movie. It really is. I'm going to get all kinds of letters now saying that I'm discriminating against women, but you know what I mean. My sister couldn't watch that movie by herself, I'll tell you that right now.
Which is ironic, because if a major character in the movie is a female character, a Russian woman who
right.
is a fighter.
Maybe I should take back the remark and not get myself in trouble with Russian women.
You don't want to dig any deeper.
Let's stop right there.
Yeah, the movie
you're
is
right. One of the characters is a woman. Yeah,
we're going to talk about Stalingrad next week, and if any of your listeners listening today are interested, they should watch that movie beforehand. And I'll have a much better idea of what we're talking about. But it's basically that focuses on a famous sniper in his exploits in Stalingrad. Again, the Battle of the Rats, the small unit engagements that characterized that battle, often fought in the sewers and in the subterranean basements and the ruins of Stalingrad.
I'm amazed how well that movie is. And how well they depict all of these stories. And I'm assuming it was not filmed in Stalingrad or in Russia. They must have been filmed somewhere else. But It is just fascinating. You're right. It would be good to watch that movie before the next show. They're showing it this week on one of the movie channels, so it may be right there. But Barry, as always, thank you so much for your time. We should tell folks that we have this page that you and I started where we're putting all the shows so people can listen to the shows now, or they can go back and listen to the previous channels, previous episodes. So we have that, and I'm very happy that you started that, Barry.
Yeah, and it's, when I went back and listened to some of our other shows we've done, particularly the World War One series, I was amazed that there was just a wealth of information there that we've been able to impart. And we want to get a place where people could find it. It's, you know, you always need to read. You'll never learn as much as you can learn from listening to a broadcast that lasts an hour long as you would for reading a good book about the subject. But this is a great primer for anybody who's interested in these subjects. So,
That's right.
If you like this subject, if you're interested in John Bazelon, for instance, there are books written about the guy. If you're interested in Guadalcanal, mm-hmm. there's books written by veterans of Guadalcanal.
Right.
And this might be a good way to introduce it to you. And then if you want to learn more, that's the way to find out.
That's exactly right. Well, have a great week. And we'll follow up next week with the Battle of Stalingrad. That is a great chapter of the history as well.
I look forward to it. And as always, it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, our good friend from the West Coast, our military historian, and we love doing these shows with Barry. It's just a lot of fun, a lot of history, a lot of information, as they like to say. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.